You're listening to the Washington AI Network podcast, the winner of two 2025 Communicator Awards, one for excellence in the science and technology category and an award of distinction for our episode on healthcare AI, featuring tech legends Ted Leonsis and Grant Verstandig. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network podcast. We're so glad you're here. It's the beginning of our CTO sessions. We have very, very special guests, some very special people in the room. And to get things started first, I want to introduce you to a friend and colleague, Arun Gupta. Arun is the CEO of the Noble Reach Foundation.
Amy, thank you for your partnership and friendship and bringing everyone together. And thank you for all the guests that joined us here today and the CTOs from government. I mostly want to thank, first of all, the scholars that we have in our next cohort here at Noble Reach. These are best and brightest that are speaking with their most valuable asset, which is their time, to come in and serve in public service at the federal level, the state level, the local level. And with the notion that what they are helping us grow is a community of dual citizens, public-private sector citizens. They may go to the private sector as well. But in doing that, they'll be ambassadors. They'll create connectivity. I mean, ultimately, they'll bridge the trust deficit that we currently have between the public and private sector. We've been fortunate. We had our first cohort last year. We had 250 people apply for 20 spots across 8 federal agencies. And this last cohort, that we had about 1,300 people engaged in the process, and are, we'll be placing 30 across federal, state, and local. It's our job to help modernize the infrastructure to connect them to these opportunities in a way that allows more of them to be coming in. And so think of us as like Teach for America, but pointed at public service, not public education. We're looking to scale and create a broader movement so that we have hundreds and then thousands kind of going in annually. I mean, changing the narrative of why it's important to start your career around public service. So with that, it's been great to have, partners like Tammy and those of you that are here are on this journey. And we think we're just beginning. So thank you.
We're excited to welcome everyone to our first ever CTO session. Yes, we're kicking off this new series with a powerhouse session in military intelligence, technology, and innovation. Tonight's guest serves at the highest level of the U.S. Army as Chief Technology Officer to the Chief of Staff, Dr. Alexander Miller. Let's welcome him. He is battle-tested with a career that includes serving as Deputy Chief of Staff for Science and Technology, guiding intelligence operations, and pushing the boundaries of what's possible in the battlefield. Dr. Miller has led the charge in getting cutting-edge capabilities directly into the hands of soldiers in the field, ensuring real-time testing, rapid feedback, and mission-ready solutions. From the war room to the front lines, he's been a leader at the intersection of strategy, technology, and national defense. Now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Miller. Thank you so much. But I'm going to call you Alex.
Please do.
Thank you very much. Okay, I want to start with the AI action plan that was announced recently from the White House. And what's the Army's approach?
That's a big meeting question. So if you haven't read the AI action plan, I do recommend you read it. So normally government policy is pretty dry. It's hard to read. It's not written in plain English. But the action plan has a couple of really good things in it, particularly on how we induce innovation and then how we actualize and implement artificial intelligence. But there's also a lot of key enablers in there, because normally when the government starts talking about AI or ML or distributed ledger or blockchain or insert any tech buzzword, there's not really a thought about who does it and how do you implement it. So the AI action plan flips that on the head a lot. It talks about the talent behind how you implement AI. It talks about the foundational enablers. It gets into things like infrastructure. So as a service, of course, we're under the Department of Defense, so we don't do many things unilaterally. What we are going to do is think through the missions and the workflows that are best suited for this class of technology. And I say that very deliberately because, dirty secret, is not every problem's an AI problem. Part of this is rationalization. Don't try to throw the wrong solution at the wrong problem and you don't end up with bad architecture. So there's a couple of things that we're doing. In terms of infrastructure, our CIO, my battle buddy, Leo Garciga, he has recently put out some major investments into things like foundational LLM models, making those available and democratizing them to do things like in the AI action plan, it talks not only about warfighting for the Department of Defense, but also back office things. So
well,
how do
wait though. So are you saying Army is making their own AI, or how does that work?
Kind of. I don't like to compete with industry. I think that's a bad proposition. I think it's one, just bad for taxpayers. Two, it's not good value for soldiers. So what we're doing is in areas where industry is way ahead, like I don't need to compete with the frontier AI providers. They're probably doing pretty okay without me building a off-the-shelf LLM. We'll just adopt those, and then we'll tailor them to whatever our mission is. For things that are bespoke to us, so for example, in 2017-18, the Department of Defense got really serious about this whole AI thing. We said we're going to do AI, and we started this thing called the Algorithmic Warfare Cross-Functional Team. Everybody knows it as Maven. We started with a really hard problem, which is how do you take video from our drones, and then how do you apply AI to it? How do you find stuff in pictures, because people like pictures? No one else was doing that at the time, especially on the grainy video that we had. So in that case, we did. We built our own. Now, you know, 8 years later, there's a lot of computer vision work out there. We can go to almost any provider and get that. So as technology becomes available, what we want to do as part of the Army Transformation Initiative, and I don't want to throw a lot of Army buzzwords out because that's not fair to anybody else, but as we think through like how we transform our Army to provide the best technology the fastest, adopting and adapting technology that's available is goal number one. Only developing what we have to develop. Like the Army is really, really good at developing munitions and explosives and propulsion stuff. So we're going to keep doing that, but we're not going to compete with industry on things like autonomy, on things like robotics, on things like computer vision, areas where we know there's a commercial solution.
So you're saying you're going to directly to commercial operations and saying, can you make this for us? Is that like, you know, the primes, Lockheed and all those guys? I mean, or how does it work?
Kind of. Not really.
Okay.
And here's why I say
we'll
that.
We'll cut that part out.
No. It's an important conversation. So the process, so the government has a process for how we procure things, how we buy things. And normally that process starts with, I'm going to write a bunch of words down. They don't mean anything, and they won't mean anything when we buy the stuff that we say we're going to buy. But it's the process because somebody said we had to do it. What we have done is tried to flip that on the head where we say, if you're the warfighter, if you're the soldier, you probably know the thing that you need right now better than anyone else, certainly better than the Pentagon does. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to pick the right thing. There's that 10th use case, right? Like Henry Ford's attributed was saying, if I gave the people what they wanted, I would have given them a faster horse. That's the 10th use case, not the first 9, where we have to go, hey, maybe there's something else. But what we wanted to do is say, what do you need? Let's write a very short requirements document. Like our next generation command and control document is 3 pages. And there's a graphic, so there's 3.5 pages. And then we spent a year just getting technology into our soldiers' hands to try it and get direct feedback. Normally, if we wanted to go through the process, and I've run this several times as a former intelligence professional and now, that process can take 7 to 10 years, easy. Some of it is learned helplessness. Some of it is malaise. Some of it is just we're trying to do really hard things in a really inefficient way sometimes.
And how do you work with the other services? I mean, you're
competitively.
No. Oh, yeah. No.
So I'll give you a couple
of
examples.
Because if they are working on their own AI, I mean, now we're in the middle. I mean, this is so crazy that right now, even as we speak, we're going to get to this week with ChatGPT-5, et cetera. But every week, something else comes out. Right. And you've got all these services and departments. How does that all coordinate? Or not?
Sometimes it does, sometimes. And that's an unromantic answer. I'll give you a couple of tangible examples. For things that really need to be democratized, we actually work really well across the service. So the CTO for the Navy, Justin, he and I are partners here. So if he finds something that we're going to use, generally we can use it. The CTO for U.S. Central Command, so headquarters in Tampa, but owns the Middle East where we had a lot of the global war on terror, Joy. Same thing. So she's more of a customer, but if she says, here's something that I see that's good for troopers in my area, we'll pick it up and use it somewhere else. There are areas where it makes sense for us to compete on the edges. And I'll give you an example. So like the Navy is going to build submarines. If I find that the Army is building submarines, I think we have a problem. The Air Force is going to build the collaborative combat aircraft. even though the Army has more boats than the Navy and more airplanes or aircraft than the Air Force, they're going to do that way better than we are. So I'm going to let them do that because that's their job. And if I find something that's useful for them, a drone that comes off of their aircraft, an AI model that's good for their cameras, a better way to communicate, a better radio, then we'll share those. We're actually pretty good at that as a department. Where we have gotten better in the last 6 months to a year is finding the things that don't make sense and stopping them, which is actually the hardest thing that I've done as a professional in this city.
And why are you able to do that now?
We're much more vocal, and I don't want to use the word combative because that's got sort of a negative connotation, but for a long time, we just wouldn't say this thing's dumb. Like, it just needs to stop. It doesn't make sense anymore. And now we have leadership that are willing to say, we don't want to spend money on this. It was a good idea at the time, mostly. However, it's come to the end of its life and it needs to be sunset, when before we would actually just keep paying for it and keep budgeting for it and then try to do the new thing in addition to it. Bad value, like doesn't actually add value. Or worse, what we try to do is take something that is no longer relevant and keep strapping things to it to make it relevant. It was like, I'm looking at here and you're all young. I had a Nokia phone, like it was indestructible, but our process today would take that Nokia phone and try to make it an iPhone when we could just buy the iPhone. So that's what we've been trying to do.
So you were deployed in Afghanistan.
I was.
And you were recently overseas. I don't know if you want to say where you were. Talk about the difference, because what you're saying is, you know, someone in the field can say, we really need this, and headquarters is going to be responsive.
They are. So when I was in Afghanistan, I worked for the J2. I own the intelligence architecture in Afghanistan. We had a lot of ways to work around the process. So we had this thing called overseas contingency operations money. It was funny money. We had infinite amounts of it. I'm saying that sort of facetiously, but we could move really quickly. We had this document called a 10-line requirement. It was literally 10 lines on a piece of paper. We could get whatever we needed. That was a workaround to the way that the government does procurement. And it was a workaround out of duress. We did that because we had to solve problems. Today, we're trying to fix the process so that that's no longer a workaround. It's just the way the process works. It helps us save money. So I spent the better part, it's August now, I spent almost all of July in the Pacific. So I had an opportunity to travel with the chief and the secretary, and we did Hawaii because that's where a lot of our headquarters are, and then Kwajalein Atoll, which if you've never looked at history, Kwajalein Atoll is an awesome area that we've done research for better part of the last century and all of this.
What kind of research?
So like missile testing, particularly on hypersonics and radar and all kinds of signatures coming out of that
stuff.
Area. Big stuff. We were in the Philippines with one of our multi-domain task forces. And if you've never been around the Army, that is just an organization whose sole purpose in life is to bring together all of the best capabilities, whether it is missiles or long-range aviation aircraft or drones or AI and for targeting and finding the bad guy and just doing it very far forward. So not in the United States off, you know, meeting our enemy where they are. It was also in Guam, looking at the Guam defense system. And then I took leave, so I had fun in Japan.
I see. So you're around the world. Everyone else is bringing AI into their operations. Did you pick up anything else from other countries? I mean, are you working collaboratively? We've just talked about working within the
Absolutely.
Department.
So I have some of my UK colleagues here in the front row.
Yes, let's hear it. Everybody there, Jade and Devin. Welcome, welcome.
So before I went to the Pacific, I was actually in the UK and in Germany. So yes, we have been running. So I talked about this Army Transformation Initiative. So General George started it last year, and Secretary Driscoll came on board and then poured gasoline on that fire. And the whole point there, and I'm telling you this sort of deliberately, is modernization is about things. Transformation is about process and culture. So one of the things that came out of this Army Transformation Initiative was we have to get really serious about counter drones. Because when I grew up in the global war on terror, and my deputy here, Anthony, and I know Dave Butler's running around, we all dealt with the improvised explosive device problem. And the reason that was a challenge is because it is really easy to make bombs, and it is really hard to detect them. And when you have an adversary that doesn't care about anything other than trying to kill you, they get really good at finding ways to kill you. I cannot stress this enough. What you're seeing in Europe with the drones, those are airborne IEDs. It is a bomb that can fly 100 miles an hour. we have to get really good at countering those. So we started this exercise called Flytrap. That was the US terms. The UK's term was Vanaheim. As a geek, that's a very cool name. But the goal was, how do you bring all this technology to bear for the soldier, for his or her squad, for their platoon, so that you can counter drones automatically? So we saw a lot of this technology. So the first Royal Yorks, that was the UK unit that was there. I got to go see in Germany a lot of the technology that we're bringing. So things like, how do you see the electromagnetic spectrum and then identify the drone in it and then immediately put a countermeasure? So either jam it or do some other spicy magic with physics to bring that drone down. So our guys, 2nd Cavalry Regiment and the 1st Royal Yorks, were doing that. So I saw a lot of technology that the UK was bringing to bear and brought it. The next stop, well, one of the areas that I was at in the Pacific was Australia. So what the Australians are doing, they fired one of their precision strike munitions, so new long-range missile. But they're also thinking about how do you sense in the environment, how do you decide, and then how do you act immediately? Because we know that if we're if things go really bad and we're against a high-end threat, you have to act faster than they can. And I know we're talking about a lot of the sort of tip of the spear sort of warfighting things, but all of that starts right here. Like we talk about warfighting things, but all of it starts here. For things like how we pay our soldiers, how we deploy our soldiers, how we manage our talent, how we manage those soldiers. So what I saw, just to answer your question directly, was I saw a lot of high-end tech from both the UK and Australia. I got to work with some of our other partners in the Pacific, and we are bringing a lot of those lessons back and just institutionalize them because we can.
And what about Ukraine? What have you learned from Ukraine?
The most important thing is actually listening to the edge, because they're going to see the problem way faster. So I'll give you a finite example. We, as part of the Army Transformation Initiative, we have this concept called transforming in contact, which is normally, I talked about how the Pentagon would wait for several years to make sure that we just got those words on paper just so good, and then we would go buy something. Well, the whole idea of transforming in contact was, what if we just didn't do that? What if we went to soldiers and said, I'm going to give you a lot of technology. You're going to tell me what works. And more importantly, you're going to tell me what doesn't work. So what we're seeing in Ukraine is a lot of that drone technology, both offensive and defensive. And what we have started doing was, our first unit that went through transforming contact, so 2nd Brigade, 101st, so Screaming Eagles, you know, history of World War II, they had about 150 quadcopters. And they were rather expensive because the supply chain in the United States is not quite where it needs to be there. The second unit that went through there, so 2nd Brigade, 25th Infantry Division out in Hawaii, you know, Tropic Lightning, they had about 250. So then in February, I found myself with 3rd Brigade, 10th Mountain Division in Hohenfels, Germany. And if you've never been to Hohenfels, Germany in February, it's awesome. You should definitely try it out. It rained, ice rain, for the first 3 days, and then it was about 23 degrees for the last 7 days. We gave them about 350 drones. So we crushed them with technology to go, what can you do? Where's your breaking point? Where do you get so saturated that you can't do your jobs anymore? And I'm proud, because every single time they said, more, we'll take it. What was really cool, and this gets back to sort of the AI action plan and some of the things in there for infrastructure, is when you're in 20 degree weather and it's wet and it's cold and you're tired and you're hungry, like the four worst things you could possibly be at the same time, batteries tend to fail, circuits get very brittle, quadcopters fail, AI doesn't quite work the way it's supposed to because your compute is, you know, I would say jacked up. But when you get moisture into computers and then it freezes and then it thaws because of the heat from the thermal processors, computers start to act sort of wonky. So we saw all of that. So it's not just, hey, what cool AI can I throw at the problem? It is, how do I use this in my everyday life? And if you want a perfect example of where this fails, who's gone to the beach with your iPhone and you get the, hey, you're overheating warning? Yeah. That's an environmental concern that we don't normally think about until we're in it. So I could talk about soldiers all day long. I love this.
And there are 443,000 in the Army now?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I should ask Dave. No, so where's Dave Butler?
When I checked their dashboard. Yeah, when I checked
their
so we have a dashboard that has all this data live for the chief and the secretary. We had about 458,000 when I walked out today.
And what about the keeping the soldier in the loop and the questions about when do you just do what the AI tells you versus, you know, someone looking at the decision and making their own decision?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So the Army has, the Department of Defense has this policy. It's a DoD Directive 3000.09. It's called Lethal Autonomous Weapon Systems. It sounds awesome. It was originally designed with the intent to say, if you're going to build a killer robot, here's how you do it. It was interpreted as don't build killer robots. So we rewrote it a couple of years ago, and the whole intent was you have to, the quote is, imbue appropriate levels of human judgment, right? So that's a nice meaty sentence for everybody to interpret differently. What we are doing is the commander and a soldier has to make a decision.
And two that, of them.
No. Just like the user. Okay. The user. And that decision can come in at any time in the loop. So let's say that we know that anything that way is probably a bad guy. And we set up a vehicle and it's got a way to just affect everything that way. Commander's made a decision, right? So that's the direction. The user has said, I'm going to put my robot here and it's not going to turn this way. It's not going to turn that way. It's only going to look in the direction that I want it to. That's human. That's human on the loop. They have made a decision. They've set all the conditions and they've given it boundary conditions, and that's okay. If we're doing something a little bit more exquisite where we are going to cause harm to life or limb of an adversary, that's when we get to decide, hey, if it needs to be automatic, we're going to make it automatic because I will prioritize protecting. So like I will prioritize engineering solutions that protect soldiers 100% of the time over risk management, because risks are meant to be managed, not mitigated. Like if you've worked in cyber at all, you're very familiar, but risks are meant to be managed, not mitigated.
What about the enemy? Name the enemy. Are they, they're not conducting it the same way. They're going to do what's most expedient and takes most. So how do you manage that? AI?
We still want to be the good guys, right? So Team America still wants to be the good guys. Team AUKUS, Team Five Eyes, like we still want to be the good guys. So we do put moral boundaries on our technology. And there's a reason for that. So as we think about what's right and what's safe and what's prudent, we just build the engineering stops in there to do that. And that's the key. If you build a system to be the most risk adverse, you can't downgrade it later. If you build the system the right way, you put the right engineering stops from the start, then you have options when you're in a fight and you can go, hey, full on conflict, like we have to win this because the only way to survive is to win versus nope, we're gonna make sure that we clear that building appropriately. We're gonna make sure that we check everything, you know, dot our I's, cross our T's.
Okay, I'm gonna move back to Washington. Does Sam Altman call you all the time and say, hey, Alex, do you want to try this ChatGPT-5? And I do want to ask you about ChatGPT-5. How do you deal with the hyperscalers?
Okay, so that's a great question. So for the cloud provider, like the hyperscaler CSP for the cloud service providers, we actually have a great relationship. So the department put up the JWCC, and I can't actually remember what that acronym stands for anymore, but it's our way for how do we engage with your Microsofts and your Amazons and your Googles and your Oracles and your IBMs. It's awesome. We have moved, again, our CIO is a great partner. We've moved all of our contracts there. When I was in the intelligence community, CIA was the first mover, right? So we put Amazon behind the fence so we could have these enclaves, and then Microsoft came in with the C2E. That relationship has continued. If you look at the other types of hyperscalers, your platform providers as opposed to your infrastructure providers, I think in the last year and a half, we've hypercharged everything. So the Army just signed an enterprise license with Palantir, scraped data platform. So we'll be able to provide that OSDK out, and anybody who wants to build on top of that will be able to build on top of it.
Can you talk about, because Palantir is controversial, what it is unique about what they do versus, you know, Salesforce, some of the other guys?
Sure.
Or whatever you're comfortable saying.
No, it's a good question, because one of the first principles for how we want to do business is to allow companies to be really good at what they're really good at. And that's different. Like the Department of Defense, and I don't know how the other departments have been doing it, we have forced, if you won a contract and you were terrible at 10% of it, we'd just be okay with you being terrible at 10% of it, or 50% of it, or 60% of it. So Palantir is a really good data platform, just really good data platform. Salesforce is a really, really good CRM tool. We're actually using Salesforce as part of our Army accessions information environment. So you've seen the Army have a huge boost in recruiting over the last year. That's because we gave our recruiters a tool that actually worked and said, hey, the same way that we're going to do lead management and recruiting, like any company would, let's just do it that way.
Okay, let's go back to Sam Altman and all those guys. So they call you, they pitch you. How does that work? Because the reason I ask is everyone else wants to, you know, we're hearing from Meta, everyone wants to do a deal with the Defense Department.
They do. I think it's really cool that defense is cool again. I think it's really important.
Is defense cool again, guys? This crowd agrees.
You know, I'm proud American. I'm happy that people actually want to defend the homeland. Makes me happy. Yes. So all the companies call, and actually they're all really good to work with. Here's sort of the reality, right? So we don't have infinite money, so we have to be better customers. So the Chief Data and Artificial Intelligence Office, the DoD CDAO, just did a deal for several of the Frontier members.
Right.
OpenAI was one of them. However, you asked a different question earlier. You said, do they give you access to the models early?
Correct.
We are working with several of them to look at boundary conditions. So if you look at what a lot of the language domain models and LLMs do, they can do some pretty spooky stuff, from new chemistries to new material sciences. We want to have access to those to look at what the threats are. So what's in the realm of medical technology that we should be aware of, or biosciences or bioterrorism? So we have a really good relationship with those foundational model organizations.
So you're asking them to give you access.
We are. And not in a way that gives us free stuff, right? Because we want to be good customers, but it is a way for us to help them, because all of the, what I've noticed, I'm starting to see a lot of companies stand up venture arms, which is very cool, but they still have research arms, and they want those data back from us because we're willing to try really weird cases all the time for them.
Well, let's talk about startups next and venture, because they're all here. You know, the AI Action Plan announcement was the Hill and Valley folks who have played a really significant role here.
It is fascinating to see how many defense primes now have venture shops. It's actually pretty cool. What we have done internal to the Army is reinvented. We had this program called the SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research. It went underutilized for several years. So Dr. Matt Willis, who runs that in our research and technology shop, has really reinvented that. We also have this thing called X-Tech, where we will put out solicitations that are only open to small companies, only open to them. And that is our way to incubate. You have to win. It's competitive. But what's really cool is if you get an SBIR contract from the Army and you prove that you can do it, we can go to production off of that. Like, we can scale that SBIR phase one or two into production. So I'll put a plug in for every year. We have this thing called the Association of the United States Army Conference here in DC. I've been going since I was a kid. My dad was a soldier. It's really cool. If you only go to look at tanks and the infantry squad vehicle, which looks like the Warthog from Halo, go see that stuff. Go see what your Army's doing. But during this year, unique to any other year, we actually will have a pitch day. We will have the ability for a Shark Tank, and we will have all of our organizations that own everything from like venture scouting up through acquisition in one place, so we can have this conversation linearly to go, here's what happens. Here's how here's how a bill becomes a law. Here's how a startup gets into the Army.
So that's all the Noble Reach scholars. I'll see you there. It's in October.
Second week of October.
It sounds like you're saying that the Army has the biggest opportunity, that everything is focused on opportunity and transformation, because no one ever said that about the Army before. Sorry. Happy 250th anniversary. I think that's one of the most startling. That week, the parade was super cool. I love the robot dogs, camo robot dogs.
Yeah.
Boston Dynamics provided that. I'd like to have them over here sometime at the Washington AI Network. But it's remarkable the amount of transformation. It seems to be your calling card now, right? An opportunity. Never heard that before.
Yep. It's I cannot speak highly enough about the Chief General George and the Secretary, Dan Driscoll, because they're pushing it. And General George is one of the coolest guys I've met. Like, I will say this every single time. He commanded at every echelon in the Army in combat, and that is super rare. So he was a battalion, brigade, division, corps commander, and now he's the chief, and that's amazing.
Yeah, a round of applause for him.
And then what he has done as the chief, and what the secretary has supported, is he has put the right people in the right job. So like our global communications with Colonel Butler there, like being able to get our message out, we just didn't do that before, because if you think about it, since literally 9/12/2001 till now, we have been decisively engaged. Like the global war on terror is still a thing, and the Army's been at the core of it. The fact that we turned 250 this year and the nation will turn 250 next year, that's a plus. But the Army never got a chance to go, ooh, we're going to stop and we're going to take a knee and we're going to reinvent ourselves. And we are doing that literally in real time, which is where Transforming in Contact came from.
Okay, I'm going to switch again because I want to ask your view of ChatGPT-5. There's been some criticism this week. You're on the front lines of technology. Any comments?
Sure. And I'm going to ground it here. So when I was doing my dissertation in 2002, 2003, I was doing it on distributed ledger, and it was fascinating to me because like all of the blockchain mining of whatever coin you wanted, whether it was a real coin or a meme coin or whatever, consumed more energy than Ireland. Like that was the metric that we had in like 2001, 2002, and 2003. It is fascinating how power hungry LLMs are. They're infrastructure hungry, they're power hungry. What I find really cool about GPT-5, and there's a lot of hate on it, is it's much more power efficient. So was there a huge increase in intelligence? Not that I've seen online. But what we saw with 4.0 was a massive consolidation in power efficiency. What we see with 5 is another massive consolidation in power efficiency. So what we are looking for is not only how do you be more efficient with your power, because power is money, but what is the metric that we might start looking at in terms of intelligent gain to power consumption ratio? Because eventually I want to be able to run those on the edge. And what I mean on the edge is not just like the parochial, not in the cloud. I mean, eventually I'm going to run those LLMs on soldiers' faces with smart glasses. And I'm going to run them on their phones with the things like the Android Assault Kit. I'm going to run them on their vehicles for maintenance. And I'll because we're doing so much, so I have lots of examples. One cool thing that we're doing right now is we train our own maintenance professionals. So if you know, all of the people who take care of our vehicles. And normally the way that training goes is every vehicle, so like the Humvee's 40 years old, comes with this book, and they figure out how to take care of that vehicle. Well, we just started buying this thing called the Infantry Squad Vehicle. It comes off of the GM Defense Chevy Colorado line. We are taking about 1,000 hours of video recordings of our engineers and our maintenance folks just repairing that, because we're going to train a visual LLM that they can put on smart glasses and diagnose a problem and have it walk through, generate the way that you address that problem. And that is paired with another project that we have, which is what if we just digitize the logbook or digitize the support book, so that if somebody's looking through it on like a HoloLens 2, they can just go, hey, I need to go here. So we will have two different versions. One is smart lookup, which is, you know, more machine learning, and one will actually be generative in terms of how do we do this. It has to run on their face, and it has to run in a way that doesn't get so hot that we burn our soldiers. So like anything that's power consumption friendly is good.
That's amazing. You know, Joanna Guy's here from Booz Allen, and she helped put together Space Llama. And I ran into, I've been told you, Senator Mark Kelly.
Space Llama is awesome.
And
just the name.
I said, oh, you know, I just told him that I had met you and that you launched this. And if you don't know, Space Llama is the AI in the International Space Station that they use. And I said to him, I said, it's incredible because all the manuals are right in there. And he said that when he was in space, that the biggest problem they had is that all the manuals were, you know, like 15 feet high, and they had to drag them everywhere, and they had to look up all this sort of stuff. Anyway, thank you. Good work on space. Good work on Space Llama. Okay, so you've got 400 and some thousand soldiers, okay, and you've got this new technology. How do you get them to trust AI in whatever way you're working on it? I mean, do you have to educate them?
Sometimes. So, and again, unromantic way to say that, if something works, soldiers will use it. Any of our customers will use it, the same way that we use it. So if something works, we'll use it. And we'll use it right up until the time that it we'll use Waze right up until the time that it sends us to the wrong place. And then I think that like Waze did it to me on purpose. The same thing with all of our technology. If it doesn't work, we get maybe one try to regain that market share, which is the soldier's trust. That's one side of it. when we start talking about trust as it comes to AI, that's sort of taken on its own sort of world. When I was doing the intelligence thing, we had this metric called confidence. So you would have confidence in your intelligence assessments, confidence in how you're doing, you're finding things or you're finding people. And I think that translates rather well to how we implement AI. And it's the user's confidence that the thing that they're getting out of it is actually useful. You know, as a computer scientist, it's very easy to dive into, well, AI is not really giving you predictions. If it's generative, it's like a string of statistically relevant words. If it's like computer vision, it's like a list of like, hey, here's what might be happening. That's not useful when we talk to our soldiers. It's not useful when we talk to warfighters of any flavor. What is useful to them is, hey, I think this will make your life about 10% better. Now, I say that to say this. What I have noticed in the department, and I'd be curious of the rest of the government, is generally we have applied AI to dehuman human-centric tasks. And that is a very suboptimal way to approach technology. We have treated AI like a cognitive prosthetic, not really like a real force enabler. So the other thing that we're trying to work through within the Army is how do we take all these old human-centric processes and reimagine them so they are machine-centric processes with human on the loop where we need to, but it's really enabling the mission, not just strapping more stuff to the person, because the person is the most important, is the rarest, it is the scarcest resource that we have, because it's really like we want to take care of people. But if we can take them out of that process and build the right process for them and then hyper enable them so that they're an AI crew chief rather than like an AI user, that's where you get gains.
Okay, what about China?
I am a firm believer, and I say this unabashedly, I'm a firm believer that American ingenuity is better than Chinese ingenuity. I just am. Now, that's like the stump speech thing. What we are trying to do is make sure that everything we do is force enablement. And what I mean by that is what you're seeing in Russia and what you're seeing in the Pacific is, hey, one guy can fly one drone or one gal can fly one drone. I want to make sure that one soldier can fly 100 or 1,000. Like those are the types of gains where we stop being very linear about our thinking about technology and we start getting exponential. That's the only way that we continue to deter China. That's because they have to know every day that when Xi wakes up, not today. I'm not sure what they're going to do. They've done enough. That's what every day has to be in China. Not today.
What about DeepSeek?
It's fascinating, right? I like how they lied about not having to use H100s. So, but it is very proof positive that they're dependent on American ingenuity because like that's who built all of those chips that they had to use.
And
there's also one thing. And back to the AI action plan. If you look at I think it's the last section of part one of the innovate side. There's a combating. I can't remember if it's disinformation, but wrong information in there. And then there's another part that is making sure that like LLMs don't have bias in them. Okay. I think this speaks directly to that. Like we want to make sure that whatever we deploy is just the best technology. And what we saw with DeepSeek was there's propaganda in it, like you would expect. So what we don't want to do is try to counter that because that's not worth countering. We want to make sure that our technology does the right thing for us all the time. And then I think globally users will adopt the better technology. And that's not a military thing. I think just users will adopt the better technology, which means that we have to build the better technology.
So the next AI summit is going to be in India in February. Will you play any role? Does the Army or the military get involved in that kind of gathering?
I probably won't. I suspect CDAO at the department level will. However, when we have the CDAO data councils or the CTO councils, that's where I jump back in and have a pretty large voice for the service.
We have some other CTOs in the audience. We're not going to identify them because they don't like to be identified. But isn't it amazing that your role has grown from, technology, now you have to be a teacher, now you have to analyze and make fast decisions?
Yes. Yes, a direct question, you get a direct answer. It has.
So how do you balance it all?
poorly sometimes. What you have to do is just, you have to be responsive. I don't like the notion that the job will be static at any point. Maybe just because that's the adrenaline junkie in me. Maybe it's just because if I find myself being static, that's problematic, because that means I'm not adapting for our soldiers. However, what I have seen is there's a lot of title hunting happening right now. There's a lot of these weird chief X officers popping up, and I don't know what they do, and I don't know what they're supposed to do. So what I have found very comforting, maybe, is all of the CTOs that I've met in the government, and most of them were in the Department of Defense, but across the government, have been very, very mission focused. They understand what their job is. They understand what the value to their customer is, and they understand, or at least are developing a plan to deliver better value to their customers. Before, I've seen all kinds of titles, and I don't think they're delivering value.
I totally agree. That's why we're so glad to hear you here today. You said one thing in another podcast that I just want to close on, that when America gets in trouble, who do they call?
Someone say
the Marines, out of here.
So I know this is a little parochial. When the world dials 911, the phone rings at Fort Bragg. And Fort Bragg is the center of the Army universe. And that is because no matter what happens in the world, the Army responds. So the Army is your global reaction force. It is your immediate reaction force. It is your Homeland Defense Brigade, like 10th Mountain is on the border, the southern border. It is your Corps of Engineers. So when the bridge had to be rebuilt in Maryland, that was your Army. We are everywhere, all the time, every day. We do everything. And that is why I'm just proud of the Army, because we are literally on every continent, every day, doing every mission that the nation asks us to.
Well, we're very proud of you. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.